fantasies reveal a lot about ourselves. Our phobias, our hidden desires, our unexamined motives. And group fantasies also say a lot about our culture, our society's real values, as opposed to the ones that get so much lip service. And that may be part of what accounts for the fantastic popularity of shows like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? 363 original episodes. Started back in 1999, there are 3,000 episodes still in syndication. Back in the day, I quite often found myself watching for the same reason as 18 million other viewers who were tuning in, pitting my wits against the contestants to see if I could answer the tough questions, like what's the capital of Australia? Hint, it's not Sydney or Melbourne. Yeah. You know, groaning when they would miss the easy ones in this 1950s Chuck Berry tune, which classical composer was asked to roll over? The questions were they were harder than you expected, but they weren't impossibly hard, so any of us could sit there watching the TV and imagine that it could be us listening to Regis ask, is that your final answer? And, you know, maybe we would be the ones winning big time, and who hasn't at one time or another entertained that fantasy of instant wealth and riches? And while I did watch and enjoy the show on one level, I was also bothered by it because, you know, I had to ask what accounted for the amazing ratings it got? Why did it spin off this host of imitators from Slumdog to Who Wants to Marry a Multi-Millionaire? You know, all with the drawing card of quick money with no real expenditure of effort. I had to ask myself, why is it that so many Americans, their fondest dream seems to be winning the lottery? Why is it that gambling is now such a huge industry? You know, entertainment, people spend more in casinos than they spend on movies and sports and the music industry combined. What accounts for the growth of day trading in stocks? You know, people who think they can make a quick dollar without any of the patience or self-discipline of traditional investors. I think the popularity of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire can be explained because it touched a cultural nerve. Its Nielsen's were so high because people have started to lose the ability to separate fantasy and reality. Not only did they imagine that appearing on Celebrity Apprentice might be a good resume for being a judge or a senator or a president, more and more seem to believe that that the good life is in quick and easy reach, the good life being defined solely in material terms, and the way to get there being mostly a matter of luck and timing rather than hard work and perseverance. And this is a delusion. There may be some grain of truth in it. I don't want to say that, you know, money's not important or that the fickle finger of fate doesn't play some role in determining who becomes wealthy and who doesn't. J. Paul Getty, remember the oil man? He was asked his advice on how to get rich. He said, get up early, work hard, strike oil. And there are serious racial disparities in the distribution of wealth that need to be addressed, and men still earn more money than women do for doing exactly the same jobs. But despite all that, to a surprising extent, the people who wind up wealthy in America don't get there because they happen to be white or male or born with a silver spoon in their mouth. And they don't get there because they happen to know who invented Velcro or sang backup for the Supremes. If you look at the social and economic statistics, you find that people who really are millionaires have some very simple things in common. They save their money. They invest over time. They don't have flashy lifestyles. They don't drive expensive cars or wear fancy outfits. Most of them went to public schools, not to prep or private academies. Most never inherited a dime from their parents. Most of them expect to work hard, somewhere between 45 and 55 hours a week. These are all among the findings of Thomas Stanley and William Danko from their book titled The Millionaire Next Door, which examines the question of who really has money in America. And they dispel the illusion that millionaires live more flashy lifestyles than the rest of us. Actually, they live more frugally than most of their middle-class neighbors. And they also turn up some surprising data about ethnicity. You might not guess, for instance, that Turks or Palestinians are more than twice as likely to have $1 million as the average in American household, but that's the case. You might not know that Americans of Russian descent are much more likely to have hit the jackpot than white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, but this is what the numbers show. Many of the millionaires they found are first-generation immigrants to this country. And then it's their kids and their grandkids who fritter the money away when they become acclimated to our shop till you drop society. So you could ask the question, is it true then that anybody can get rich if they work hard, if they save, if they live simply, if they invest? I wouldn't go that far, but that does seem to be the implication of the life story of Osceola McCarty of Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Osceola made headlines back in 1995 when she donated $150,000 to start a scholarship for African American students at the state university. She was 88 years old when she set up this charitable trust, and she started work in the sixth grade when she had to drop out of school in order to take care of a sick aunt. And she spent the next 75 years taking in people's laundry, starting at $1.50 a bundle. Miss McCarty, who never owned a car and was in the habit of walking wherever she needed to go, noted that the secret to building a fortune is compounding interest. It's not the ones that make the big money, but those who know how to save who get ahead. And she recalls, "I started saving when I was just a little girl to have some candy money, and then when I got grown, I started saving for my future. I'd go to the bank once enough, hold out just enough to cover my expenses, put the rest into a savings account. Every month, I'd do that. I was consistent." And later, she started getting a little smarter and putting the money into CDs and mutual funds, but it was her consistency that paid off, and her generosity, her gift of $150,000 inspired matching gifts of triple that amount. So she created this scholarship fund of almost $500,000 for black students, and then directly inspired media mogul Ted Turner to donate $1 billion to the United Nations. Here are some of Osceola McCarty's tips for getting rich. "I don't like to waste. I keep everything. Clothes, furniture, housewares, until it wears out. Usefulness outlasts style. I don't buy clothes very often, but when I do, I try to find something on sale, and I'll spend a little more for something of higher quality if I have the money to spare. I think a Christmas savings account is a good idea. Every year I save and prepare to spend that money. It's crazy the way people will go into debt at this time of year. Credit cards, she says, are okay for some people, but I wouldn't go for one. I'm not going to spend money I don't have buying something I cannot afford. Of course, Osceola also needed some reason to save, and part of that was self-interest. A smart person plans for the future, she said. You never know what kind of emergency is going to come up, and you can't always rely on the government. You have to take care of yourself. But part of the reason, too, was she wanted to take care of others, give other people opportunities that she never had. I can't do everything, she observed, but I can do something to help somebody. And what I can do, I will do. I wish I could do more. How many of us are as rich as Osceola McCarty? Rich, not just in terms of our bank accounts, but in terms of our hearts. Is wealth measured by how much we can possess and accumulate, or what we feel we can afford to share, give away? I suspect that many of us are torn between this struggle. On the one hand, there's a desire to do well, and on the other hand, there's a desire to do good. Part of what we want from life, most of us, is security, independence, comfort. But then another part of us also wants to be part of something larger than ourselves, a community of values, a community that works together for something bigger and more lasting. There were two university professors who recently released a study on what it is that actually makes people happy. And they found out, not surprisingly, that money was one of those factors indicating whether people described themselves as being very happy, moderately happy, or fairly unhappy. But they also found out that money was not nearly as significant or important as a host of other factors, like having a good marriage. And it was only one among a whole assortment of predictors, including being part of a meaningful religious community. Being part of a faith community, like having a 40-year successful marriage, that demands a special set of attitudes and expectations on the part of the participants. If you come into this relationship with an attitude of, you know, what's in it for me? What can I get out of it? You're probably setting yourself up for disappointment. And unfortunately, that's the attitude of too many people in our cash and carry society. You know, whether it's people visiting our neighbors at St. James, or the Presbyterians are coming through our doors, they're bringing the consumer mindset of a church shopper. So they judge their experience on Sunday morning by the same criteria that they might use to judge the wares of retailers offering similar, seemingly similar products. So you know, I don't go to Starbucks, but how much does a cup of coffee go for at Starbucks now? $3? $4? Well, you know, they'll say, well, it's $4 for a cup of coffee at Starbucks, but the coffee here isn't quite as good, so it's worth $3 maybe. And they'll go to a movie with Tom Cruise, and that's $9. You know, it's good entertainment. But what about listening to Gary or Monroe? Well, they're not quite as good looking. Maybe worth $5, $4. I don't know. You know, you figure it out. And from one point of view, that's a good way to calculate what it is, the value that you receive from being part of a congregation like this one. But people who come to Unitarian Universalism, seeking spiritual goods, spiritual enrichment, are likely to be disappointed if they keep this consumer outlook. If their connection to our faith is to be more rewarding, they have to start thinking, instead of being consumers, as being co-owners or investors or shareholders in what happens here, just as the partners in a good marriage see themselves as, you know, joint partners in the success of the enterprise, making this transition from being a consumer to being an investor. It's an emotional shift, it's a relational shift, but it's also a financial shift, because at that point most people usually start giving more generously to their faith community, and the dividends that they get back are of a very different nature. Many years ago, Mohandas Gandhi made a list of what he called the seven sins of the modern world, and high on his list were these two: wealth without work, religion without sacrifice. I tend to agree with Gandhi. I think many of us suffer from the delusion that we can get something for nothing. I think that our society devalues the worth of commitment and self-sacrifice and struggle. Maybe I'm old-fashioned. In fact, I know I'm old-fashioned, but I agree with Osceola McCarty, who said that hard work gives life meaning. Everybody needs to work hard at something to feel good about themselves. Every job can be done well, and every day has some satisfactions. You know, TV game shows, they promise you instant wealth as the key to happiness, but I don't believe that promise. The question for me is, what is it that we can promise one another? And I think what we can promise each other here, we can promise each other hard work, the hard work of caring for each other in a world that is uncaring, the hard work of creating authentic community in a world where virtual communities like Facebook are becoming the norm, the hard work of trying to live with integrity in a world that's rife with sham and deception, the work of building a place where each person is valued because of who they are, not because of what they own or what they're worth. Imagining that you're going to win the lottery or that it would solve your problems, even if you did, you know, that's far-fetched. Winning the sweepstakes is 1 in 10 million. Marrying a multimillionaire, this is what TV producers call reality programming, but this is not my reality. This is TV reality. But it's not far-fetched at all to believe that every person, each one of us, we can do something significant with our lives. We can make a difference in this world. So that's what it means to be rich, in friends, in hopes, in relationships. And that's what Barbara's going to be talking about now, as the Unitarian Congregation of Taos begins its first in-person, face-to-face pledge drive. What they're going to be asking you to do is not to spend your money on some fantasy, but to consider investing in a dream.